Okay.
Well, I think I'll start out today and tell you about Charlie Hudson. He lived at Spoon Lake. He had a cabin there, and he trapped out of there. In the summertime, he rented boats. And I think in the winter of 39 and 40, Frank Howell trapped with him up Canyon Creek. Kimberly Creek, a side drainage, they had a cabin up there. And anyway, the story that Charlie tells that Frank was supposed to go over in a park, sneak into the park and trap. And he didn't miss him until about March and never come back, and so he reported him missing. And of course, Ralph there, the Forest Service, and I can't remember who was sheriff, it was before Dick Walsh. And anyway, they went up there and they looked around and they finally found part of the body that the bears had dug out of the snow and chewed it up, and they found a boot with a foot in it, and they never did find the skull. And I know Ralph spent a lot of time up there looking for the skull, and they never found his rifle or anything like that, so there's a lot of mystery there. Huh. He was a pretty tough old guy. In fact, years ago, the Forest Service, every employee was a game warden, you know, if they were supposed to enforce the law. And anyway, it was after the 29 fire, and Charlie shot a moose, and it was visible from the North Fork Road. There's snow on there, and anyway, Forest Service guy come over there and started talking to him, and he says, you know, he said, I'm going to have to turn you in. And old Charlie said, if you don't get the hell out of here, you're going to be laying right alongside of this moose. And he got away with it. They never turned him in. He had to have something to eat.
I guess had to say something, huh?
Yeah, he was a pretty tough guy.
Did you know many of the homesteaders?
Pardon?
Did you know many of the homesteaders?
Yeah, I knew Mike Burns and Walsh. John Walsh, I remember meeting him. And I knew Dick a lot better. There was one that they called Dutch that lived up there on Big Prairie, too. I remember he'd walk out in the winter about December, and we lived up the North Fork, about 4 miles up. My dad had a place in there, about where that taxidermy shop is. That's on part of his place. And he'd walk out, and I remember he'd go to town and spend overnight, and then the next day, probably about noon or so, he'd come by and Maud make him coffee. And I remember he had a sack of hard candy. There were little Santa Clauses about 3 inches high, and they were filled with strawberry jam. I've never seen anything like them since. Yeah, they were really good. I remember us kids got a sack of them when we stopped by.
Did you know homesteaders on the upper end of the valley?
Where?
In the upper end of the valley above Pole Bridge?
Yeah, I knew Ralph there, Frank Newton. You see, there seemed that there was another one there.
Holcombs, did you run into them?
Yeah, I remember them. In fact, I went to school with his granddaughter. And she married a guy in back of the homes, where they got the hall up there.
Matheson's?
Yeah, Matheson's.
Were you involved in, and we know you were involved in the North Fork Patrol, were you involved in the community hall?
Yeah.
And can you tell us about that?
Well, we got started at it. What gave us the idea, there was snowcatters, I think it was in Minnesota, somewhere up there in the Northern Peninsula, and anyway, they organized, snowcatters were going out and they'd loan them the cabins and stuff to check them out and stuff. And we kind of got the idea that way. Because when I first started in, we did a lot of it with snowcats, you know, to get around to where the people weren't there in the winter. And we finally got so we'd go by, and if there's no tracks going in or nothing, we didn't disturb it, you know. Because if you drove in with a snowcat, then you couldn't tell if somebody skied in or walked in after it froze, so we kind of quit that.
And you were president or head of the patrol for a number of years?
Yeah, for 20-some years, I guess. We got a real good guy there now.
Mark Heafy.
Yeah. He is very good, very thorough, and very honest.
Yep.
I really admire him.
Yeah, I like Mark too.
Yeah, we like him too. We stopped last week and were talking with Margaret, and then saw Mark.
He'd fit right in with the old time North Forkers.
Yes.
Yeah. He'd fit right in.
So, did you serve on the North Fork Improvement Association, the hall, or was it all together at one point?
Well, I can remember when they built it. You know, and then I was a property owner up there since 1953.
Tell me about that. Did they build it in 54?
Pardon?
Was it 54 when they built that?
Yeah, I think so. I was working for Rex Brown.
Okay.
I was working for Rex Brown up Trail Creek, and they had a big blowdown up there, and the Foresters had difficulty selling it. And anyway, they was asking the minimum bid, $1,000, and nobody would pay it. And so they asked for bids, and Rex Brown bid 50 cents, and he was the only bidder.
So that's where the logs came from for the hall? Was out of
No, I don't think they come from there. I can't remember who sawed them. It wasn't Lloyd Saunderson, it was another guy. And he sawed them. He was kind of a local guy up there.
Right.
I can't remember who it was. Yeah, I knew Ralph Day. He was a mailman for a number of years. He was Holcomb's son-in-law.
Uh-huh.
So did you have good mail service all the time you lived up there?
After 78, I got my mail downtown here because I was all over the valley. I'd be up to South Fork or over Tally Lake or somewhere all the time logging or something, you know.
So whenever you were in town, you just stopped by and got the mail on way coming or going?
Yeah, my mom picked up my mail for me.
I see.
Because you go to them logging camps, you're there for 5 or 6 days a week. It's hard to get a haircut even. All the barber shops are cold. And I remember my hair was long one time, and I just took my knife and I cut it myself. And the guy says, "Where'd you get the haircut?" And I says, "Oh, that barber up there in Martin City." And nobody would go get a haircut there.
So did you, and when you were in the logging camps, did they have cooks?
Oh yeah. Yeah, sometimes we batched.
Uh-huh.
Just depends. When we were talking, we had a cook in a cookhouse and done real well that way. A lot of times I'd be out building road and I'd be by myself, sometimes just one guy to help me put in pipes and that was it.
So was having a cook a pretty time-saving thing? You get more work done that way, or you just ate better?
Yeah. In the summertime, I usually worked daylight. When it was daylight, I worked 10, 12, 15 hours a day.
Yeah. So you could get home. That way you didn't have to spend so much time in the woods?
Well, did you get the jobs done?
Yeah.
Yeah, you had time limits, and when you get up there on them high ridges, you know, you don't have a long season. Because, you know, after, you know, when it hit the end of September, you're done with, just about done with road building, because you start getting snow, and then you got soft roads, and you have to wait till it freezes up if you're going to use them that winter.
So can you tell us about your impression of the social life when you lived up the North Fork, either one of you?
Yes, it used to be they made their own entertainment. They'd go around and have parties, and after they got the hall, they was pretty active with that. They had a 4th of July fish fry. There's one stipulation, you had to bring your own fish. But it wasn't too bad them days, you know. The guy was allowed, 10 fish?
I think
for a while it was 15, and they dropped it to 10. And now it's pretty easy to cut your limit. They got it down to 3 in the legs.
They can't get enough fish for a fish fry.
That's right.
Yeah, in the early days, there was a lot of trappers. and toward the end there, in the late 30s, the Fish and Game had a study. I've got a copy of it here somewhere, if I can find it. But it was done on the Whitefish Divide. They even had snow cats. They called them snow machines. But they had a motorcycle engine in them, and on good snow conditions, they could go. But if it was a little bit adverse, they weren't, the powder snow, they weren't any good.
So, did you get involved in trapping at all?
I trapped some, yeah. When you're working in the woods, you don't have a lot of time for trapping, you know, so. I had a job, so I didn't interfere much.
So then, have you always been a hunter? Did you hunt?
Yeah.
For meat, or how did that work for you?
Yeah, I didn't kill any, not even a grouse last year. But that's about one of the first years I've never killed anything in my life. I've got an elk every year since I was 11 years old, barring the time I was in the service.
So how did you preserve it, or keep it, or freeze it, or?
Yeah, my mom used to can it, Marietta canned it. And then we cut roast, and then when it got real modern, we got a deep freeze.
So you always had a deep freeze up there?
Not up there. We have one in town.
In town, okay.
My mother's place, and we'd stop by and pick meat out of the freezer that way.
Well, we had a smokehouse, and we preserved that way, too.
So you smoked it and then canned it?
We did some that way, but most of the time, when it come out of the smokehouse, every neighbor in the North Fork was at our house. They could smell it cooking, and they came for treats.
I see.
Same way at the hospital. I was over there for almost a year. They had that. I had to make up a bunch of smoked stuff, jerky, and bring it over to the hospital. And he'd bring it in 10, 15 pounds at a time. It'd be gone before noon. Everybody in the hospital was in there getting their share and then some.
Well, Lee, tell us about your smoker. Did you build it yourself?
Yeah.
Some of us have never had a smoker, so give us a little history on smokers.
You've got to have a little stove, you know, and be able to control the heat. I start the fire, and I use green wood to make a lot of smoke to begin with.
What kind of wood?
Alder. I prefer alder to anything. It's really good. You can use any of the hardwoods if you peel the bark off, birch and cottonwood. You can use that, but alder is the best. You don't have to peel alder. The alder doesn't have any resins in the bark like the other ones do.
So that, did you use the common one that I'm familiar with, is where they take an old refrigerator and run the smoke through that?
Well, racks. This last one I had was 4 feet square.
Oh, big.
Yeah, and 7 feet tall. And I got a thermometer on the wall, and on I don't know what my temperature is. I can just go look and see. And toward the end, I like to get it up to about 150 degrees for, maybe 45 minutes, an hour. And then your meat starts to get firm, and you can take it out, or you can dry it right down to when you bite it. It's just like biting a rock. If you want it to keep a long time, that's where you do it, get most of the moisture out of it.
So what would be an average time for your smokehouse?
How long?
Yeah.
Oh, it just depends on how thick you cut your meat. You know, you can cut it thin and get it to dry out a lot quicker, but I like mine the kind of chewy, you know. I like a little moisture in it.
Did you brine it or anything, or just smoked it as is?
I use that High Country jerky mix, and they've got about 10 different flavors in it. And I like that High Country. It's really good. The pepper mix, I think they call it.
So did you put it on as a dry rub?
Yeah, you got to use a plastic or a stainless steel can, and you just, I just got a meat block, and I put it out there, and I just lay the meat on it, enough sticks on it, and you lay it in a pan, and 24 hours later, you should about 12 hours later turn it over so it's nice and even.
It's an even
just hang it
solution
up
on it.
Smoke it. Yeah, we used to try a brine, but that's a lot more difficult, a lot more work, you know.
I had to teach him everything he knows on smoking.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because I've never canned meat. I assume you used a pressure cooker?
You bet.
Could you tell us a little bit about how that works?
You just get your, I pack raw meat in the jars and a teaspoon of salt and a clove of garlic and put the lid on it, and put them in, put the water in the pressure cooker, bring the pressure up to the temperature, which was usually about medium, and it take about 4.5 hours. Shut her off, take her off, and take her out. She's done. And the kids would gobble it up, Lee would gobble it up, but back to the smokehouse, when we were married, I was making my living, before we were married, smoking turkeys, bears, all this stuff for everybody. And I cure them, and then I married him, and I still was doing the smoked turkeys and stuff for people for Christmas and Thanksgiving. And he decided he would take on the delivery of delivering them back to the people that brought them to my house to be smoked. Well, he was coming home having a party. He was a little tipsy at times. He had fun at it, and it brought in good living.
If I got an old bull, we always used to get suet and put a chunk in there about as big as a walnut. And it gives you a little bit of fat in there to help break it down.
And then you stored your cannon in a root cellar. You had a basement in your house, right?
Up there.
Yes. How long could you store canned meat for?
Oh, I'll tell you a secret, but it's going to go in the dump up there. I have canned chicken that is still fully canned. It's been up there for 30 years that I moved from the South Fork. But I don't think I would want to eat it now. Yeah, I mean, it's fully canned.
It's still good. I checked it the other
day.
But
there's no way, after that length of time, that I would want to eat it.
Well, how do you check it, or how did you know? In other words,
You can tell.
I date my jars when I can.
Okay.
You know, I have a mark lot right in the top of the lid when they come out of the pressure cooker that day. And we moved it from the South Fork up the North Fork, and my bad weather meals. Somebody popped in that I didn't know about or something, or we had unexpected relatives pop in, we'd have dinner. And it was easy to go get a jar of elk meat, deer meat, sometimes canned grouse, and then other times just whatever was there, the chicken. But my kids, when I canned my chickens, they were all involved with them, and they thought they were some doggone pets. They didn't want to eat chicken for years. Rabbits was the same way.
You used to can cakes too in a jar.
I still do.
Yeah. Are you talking fruit cakes or something else?
Just a cake.
Well, I don't understand that. Can you explain that a little better?
Well, it's usually an applesauce cake.
Okay.
Just make up a double batch of applesauce cake and measure them out in my jars. Fill the jar half full. Put a piece of wax paper over the top glass on the lid. Put the lid on it and the sealing ring. Mm-hmm. Put them in the pressure cooker for about 25, 30 minutes. At pressure of about, must have been about 7.5 pounds. And then it would come out to fully cooked and fully sealed. Larry Wilson was really surprised. He'd come to my house. He was sitting there. I said, I suppose you want dessert. Yeah, you want dessert. And I said, well, I guess it will have to be canned cake. Never heard of it. I brought it out. He thought it was pretty good. He'd come back right regular there for a while.
So how did you get it out? Did it just slide out?
It slides out. You just put a little bit
just
of butter.
Just take a knife and go around the jar.
You didn't
you
have
can't to use that. One that's got a taper top.
Yeah, a wide mouth.
Like them freezer jars.
Right.
They work.
They just come out all by themselves. There's enough, usually, fat in your cake mix, or your, you know, when you make up your cake, and you mix it up, that it will coat the inside of the jar and it'll slide out. No, we can just about everything.
And you learned that as a child?
I've been canning since I was 6 years old.
Okay, that's
my mother had polio when she was a child. Couldn't do a lot of things. So good old Marietta was taught how to run the pressure cooker. The main thing, story behind the pressure cooker was you never left that stove when that pressure cooker's on there. And I sat right there in front of the stove. Have a book there and a timer, and that's how I do it. When it's time to take it off, then heave a big sigh. Because I've heard of people blowing pressure cookers up clear through the roof of their house. We had a neighbor lady that liked to go down to Rex's every once in a while. She put her pressure cooker on the stove. She wasn't canning. She was just cooking a roast in it. It ran out of juices and blew the pan up right through her trailer house roof.
Yeah, beans are bad in that. The neighbor lady was cooking beans in there because he could cook them faster, and a bean got up there and plugged the vent on the thing.
Oh, yeah.
And it blew up, and she had beans all over the kitchen.
It's not funny.
No, it's not.
It's funny afterwards.
So, Tom Ladenburg was your closest neighbor when you lived in the North Fork?
Yeah.
Was there anybody who was, you knew, must have known Roy Cooper.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Roy Cooper and Frank Newton. Frank Newton had a real sense of humor. When you get to know him, you know, and I was moving up there, and I said, well, gee whiz, I might have to build a smokehouse. Oh, don't build one. And he says, I'll give you one. And we was out there, and I was looking at the saddle I was going to buy from him. And then we would come back, and he says, there's your smoker. Take it anytime you want it. It was made out of river rock and about 12 feet high and built in the bank, and he said, just take it any time you want it, he said.
So were you able to move it?
Huh?
Were you able to move it?
No. I would guess it would have been a good load for a dump truck. It was working 6 days a week, and he got off a little bit early on Saturday, and you had to hurry to town. And I can remember we worked so much I couldn't even get in the stores to get a pair of shoes. I had to call a guy that owned the store, Moody, and then he'd open the store and get me a pair of shoes. Yeah, I used to wear them Red Wings, and I'd wear out two pairs every summer.
You were doing a lot of work then, huh?
Well, you're walking on those spruce logs, and the bark on them is real sharp, and it just cuts the soles right off.
Takes me 20 years.
Pardon?
Takes me 20 years.
To wear a pair out?
So what? I guess the moral of that story is you worked a lot harder than we do, or did.
Yeah, well, you know, someone
wearing boots out.
Yeah.
When he worked, he never worked close to home most of the time. It was out and away. Like when we lived up the South Fork, he worked at Spotted Bear. And he'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning just to be up there in time to go to work. Coming home would be the same way. He'd work till dark, and he still had to load up, come all the way back down to the house. And he usually get in, he'd be on the telephone with all of his crew. The next day he'd get up and we'd start loading him up again, and that would be on Sunday. And he'd be ready to head right back up the North Fork or South Fork again to go to work again. No, he spent a lot of time away from home.
Yeah, and pretty near all the roads and stuff that I built, they done away with them.
Yeah.
Schuylkill Hill and Hollowat.
Yeah.
Well, there's a commentary on today, you know, people think they have to commute a long way and a lot. They don't realize that ever since the advent of the automobile, especially in Montana, you know, you guys started out close to home and just worked your way till you were commuting long distance.
Can you imagine being little kids living up the North Fork, which on his uncle's place, Sedeby's up there, and walking from there clear to Columbia Falls to school and walking home? Little kids.
So how far is that? I can't even tell you.
About 4 miles, I guess.
You know, one way.
Yep. It's 8 miles a day.
And all the little animals?
Well,
the big animals.
I started out, I was 6 years old carrying a lunch, and I never I never quit till I was 70 years old, carried lunch all that time.
Yeah.
So did you pack your own lunches?
No, Mom packed it for me when I was a little kid.
We married out as a
But then, yeah, there was times I did. To save walking, I remember my Aunt Mary was going to school and we lived and my granddad had a place just by the tracks up the road here, just a little bit to where the North Fork Road takes off. And we'd pack our own lunches there and walk to school from there. But even from there, it was a long ways.
I'd get so sick. Clapper,
he had a homestead on Hawk Creek back in there. Him and Hugh Kurgan, they were old-time homesteaders. Yeah. And anyway, I remember he moved to town and he was janitor of the school. He'd see us kids walking and he'd keep ringing the bell till we got there so we wouldn't be tardy. Yeah, O.D. Clapper.
So how long was your school day then? Do you remember?
Oh, I think we got out about 3:30, 4 o'clock. Unless Mr. Jensen wanted us to stay afterwards, and sometimes he'd make the, if you'd done something wrong, you had to spend a half hour or an hour after school, you know, and do arithmetic or whatever he wanted you to do. Elmer Jensen, yeah.
Talking about packing lunches, I packed for him and our six kids, and I get so sick and tired of packing lunches, and we bought cheese in the little wrappers, single slices. One morning I got up and here's all these lunches to pack. I just threw the cheese in the bread, bundled it up in a baggie, put it in the lunch pails, and sent it.
Heck, that wasn't so bad, Ma. You should have had to eat them.
He come home bellowing and then he was eating plastic paper and his sandwiches.
Well, the oldest daughter learned how to bake, and she learned how to make a chocolate cake. And she had pretty good luck with it, but after about 3 months of chocolate cakes, there's no more chocolate cakes. So then she made chocolate cupcakes.
And chocolate chip cookies. He got his fair share of chocolate and then some.
So did you, when your kids got big enough then, did you have quite a bit of help in the kitchen?
Oh, each one of them got two of them to the kitchen, two of them to something in the yard, two of them to the garbage, or two of them outside with a cow, steer, you know, this sort of thing. We never had a lot of cattle, just enough to keep our kids busy. And you never cooked anything unless you made 2 gallons at a time, 2 gallons of spaghetti.
Yeah.
2 gallons of clam chowder, and you were lucky if you had enough for the next day left over.
So you raised cows on occasion, I take it.
Just for meat.
Oh, you did? I was going to ask you if you used it for meat.
Yep, just for meat. But our kids were so touchy. I mean, everything was like their best friend. They didn't want to eat it after it was killed. They'd just kind of go on strike. I'd freeze the rabbits and milk cartons, and then while they were gone in school, I'd take them out, thaw them out, get them all fixed up and ready for supper. You put them on the table and they'd say, this was sweetie pie, or this was fuzzy, or they wouldn't eat it.
So how, one of the questions we have on here, I'm just kind of jumping around, in the North Fork itself, were holidays any different than when people in town would have had?
Yes. Different, but no matter, I'll just put it this way, and I love my North Fork and I love my people. Uh-huh. You have this side and this side. There's no down the middle. But for the holidays, everybody was close together, nice to one another. Made it very nice. And to this day, when I over at the hospital over here while I was in, I would have up to 18 North Forkers in my room visiting in one day. And some of them were people that I didn't consider friends, But they came and visited and said hello and was real nice.
So I made the statement once, and I want you to agree or disagree with this. I said, what makes the North Fork special to me is the people.
That's right.
And that sounds to me like what you guys are saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then the outsiders started, out-of-state people starts moving in and stuff. Right away, you can feel every person kind of, not really bristle, but just kind of get a little leery. And the first thing you know, you'd warm up to them. They're nice people. They moved out here to get away from back east because there's such stuffed shirts back there. They don't talk to one another, never hug, never shake hands, nothing. But they come out here and you open your house up to them right away, and they're okay.
Yeah, about the first year, they really enjoyed the North Fork. And then they spent the rest of their life trying to change it to what they wanted.
And it doesn't work.
You know,
they're ruining it now.
Well, the same thing in the cities too. Columbia Falls and even Whitefish, people want to change to where they left, I guess. Yeah. Okay. Go to pause, Gary.
Early days when they come down to town, you know, a lot of people come with horses and wagons. And just up the road, just about across the road in the Glacier Rim on the old North Fork Road, there was a campground that they used there. And they used that for years. In fact, there was a big tamarack log that was cut into a horse trough so they could water the horses there.
Is that Welcome Springs?
Pardon?
Was that Welcome Springs?
I don't know what they called it. It's on the old road, and there was a bunch of big cedar trees around it. And really a nice place, no underbrush. And that horse trough laid there for years, and I had a little log hollowed out and chewed into a trough, and that run in it. Something happened that got kicked out, and then a trough just fell all to pieces. But that trough had been there, I don't know, 20 years that I knew of, and then all of a sudden it was gone. Now, we was logging back up there on the top, me and my dad was getting some cedar out, and there was a little cabin there. I could have hauled it in the back of my pickup, and I could have got it and put it in the pickup, and I let it go, and I went back about 2 years later, and I said, well, I'm going to get that, and it was gone. Somebody else had got it.
Yeah.
But it was made out of split cedar, and he had it fitted together real nice. It was probably 4 feet high. You had to crawl in on your hands and knees. And for a door, he had a piece of canvas nailed on the top and the side, and that was it. And then bear grass all over the floor. One little shelf with a candle on, a little stub of pencil, and a piece of paper there where nothing was wrote on it. And I don't know whose cabin it was, but it was some old trapper. There was a lot of trappers. I think Margaret Heafy's got the book, The Land of Giants.
I've heard the title, but I'm not familiar with the book.
Well, you want to read it if you get a chance. But it's different than most of the Western history. You know, they always start off in St. Louis and come up to Missouri. They started on the coast and come up to Columbia. And tell about all the trappers. They had a lot of Indian troubles. In fact, I think they had more Indian troubles over there than we did on this side for the divide.
That's interesting.
But there's three or four references in there in the 1830s, 1840s of guys coming up and coming into the Flathead area. And there was one, I think it was the Missouri Fur Companies. It's a book, it's out of print, and I loaned it out and never got it back, but I think it was in 1836 or 1838 when Smith went across from Salt Lake across the desert and into California and up the coast and up to Columbia. And when he got to the Flathead House, he was looking for his trappers, and they told him we're on the North Fork of the Flathead. And I found a trap in a tree that was completely grown in into a tamarack tree. You could just see enough of it to see it was a trap. Don Gimble has it out there now. I gave it to him. He's understanding it goes to Fish and Game when he's done with it. But that trap, John Fraley looked at it, and he finally got in there and he got a picture of the pan, and he said the trap was made in 1830 to 1835, somewhere in there.
That's really old.
There used to be another trap just like it in the Pole Bridge store. And I don't know, through the years it disappeared. I don't know if somebody sold it or gave it away or whatever, but it had a different chain on than what you see on the traps today.
Mm-hmm. So, you brought up the Pole Bridge store. Could you go back and tell us about the first store owner that you met, or what dealings you had, many or few, with the Pole Bridge store?
I remember Ted Ross real well. I was going by there quite a bit. And I can remember one time me and DeWitt stopped by and was gonna, well, we'd worked 6 days in the woods, and we said, well, we have a beer going to town. So we bought a six pack of beer, and Mrs. Ross wouldn't sell me a six pack of beer. She says, you're too nice a boy to be drinking beer. She wouldn't sell it to me. And George bought a six pack, so we got a beer. She'd sell it to him. He was older than I was.
They did. I remember that they didn't want to sell beer at the store.
They did, but they had to for income.
Right.
Yeah.
They had to change their mind to stay alive.
Yeah, he bought it from Ben Rover. And Ben Rover told him, if you get a bear, just shoot him with a shotgun. And he says, you'll never see him again. And he says, that's it. And so Ted did that. Every time a bear come in, he shot a bear, and finally that bear kept giving him, and he'd come hunting season, and he shot a bear. And he was skinning it out. He got a whole handful of shot. He was shooting the same bear all summer. Yeah, he took it over to Rover, and he says, Ben, look at there. He says, you told me one time, and he says, look at there. He had a whole handful of shot that he picked out of that bear.
What year did he buy the store?
Ted Ross?
Mm-hmm.
It had to be 52, 53 in there. In fact, what was the boy? Bob Ross. When I was working for Rex Brown, he worked up there for a little bit, and he set chokers for me. And then he got drafted into the Army. He had to leave before summer was over, I remember that. I gave him some good advice. I says, don't volunteer for nothing.
Did you ever tell him the story about putting in the well for Ted Ross?
The what? Oh.
The well?
Yeah, Ted drilled wells, you know. He had a deal rigged up on the rear end of his truck and a rope and a big weight, and he'd drive them down. And then he pointed the pipe on the end, and then when he got done, he'd drop a stick of dynamite down there and blow the end off. Well, he come down one day and he says, you got some fuse? And I said, yeah, I got some dynamite fuse. And so I gave him that. Pretty soon he's back, he says, you got some dynamite. He says, it didn't go off. He says, and he says, I can't get it out. The fuse won't lift it out, you know. So I says, well, I got a Kennepack. It's a pound of explosives. It's not an explosive until you squirt this juice in, and then they mix it up, and it's like dough. And I should have only used half of it, but I says, well, as long as I got it mixed up, we'll put it all down there. So we put it down there, and he already had one charge in there. So we got off, and we set that off, and boy, you couldn't believe the explosion and a cloud of smoke. And people come running out of their houses, what happened? We says, yeah, what happened? We broke every mantle in Pole Bridge.
And rattled my house 8 miles away down the road.
Okay, so I'm going to inject here, because not everybody that's going to hear this is going to understand what you just said. You broke every mantle on the Coleman lights, because they're very fragile. And yeah. I would have thought you were going to say you broke every window, but actually what you said was more important than that.
Yeah, because that's it broke all the mantles. And Bob Grimaldi's got the place now. You know, everybody in Pole Bridge has sand trouble getting in their pump and stuff. He says, I don't have any problems at all. He says, I got the best well in Pole Bridge.
So what? The wells were off the lot. Ted sold the lots down south of Paul Bridge then?
What's that?
Did Ted Ross sell the lots south of Paul Bridge?
Yeah. Yeah, he's the guy that subdivided it.
I didn't remember that. Yeah. I worked for him at age 15 or 16 and hayed that field, which is now the Paul Bridge subdivision. Uh-huh. One summer,
they used to hay that years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, yep. That was a hay field. Yeah, and then that place where Donaldson is, that was Huli Stein had it. He had them big meadows, and I thought Huli Stein homesteaded it, but he didn't. He bought it from the original homesteaders. And it was a couple of, they had that hay creek, and they had that, there was flumes out there, and when it went across the little dip, they made a wooden trough. And
flood irrigated?
They irrigated all that land out and back. That is one heck of a farm. It's got 4 feet of topsoil on it.
Yeah.
Just fabulous.
All out of that hay creek drainage?
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
And see, and hay creek isn't in its original channel now.
It's south of the original channel?
Well, now? Right there as you cross the bridge, it followed just about along the edge of that meadow, and then went back down in there by Chadwick's and went in. And in 64, Bob Olson owned that 80 acres then, and it cut across, and it had a lot of gravel in there, and he wanted it for the gravel, and the Geological Survey wanted to put it back in its original channel. He says, no, leave it there. And then after a couple of years, he thought, well, maybe better back in the old channel. And he says, it's too late now. It's going to stay where it is.
So are you saying that it ran north to start with from the bridge, or has it always run south of the bridge?
No, it runs through where the bridge is, but just as soon as you know where the house is there,
yeah,
it turned to the left. And if you look, there's an old channel.
There would be north then.
Yeah, run kind of to the east pretty much.
Okay.
You run to the north a little bit and then to the east. And then it swung to the south again.
I didn't know that.
That's the best farmland in the North Fork right there, that area there. Finley Arnett owned all of that at one time. He had 800 acres in there.
How did he get so many acres? Bought out other homesteaders?
He kept buying out homesteaders that wanted to sell out, and he got it all.
Now, you knew him, Arnett?
Yeah.
He
lived out here in Bad Rock, and he had a farm, and he was an agronomist, you know.
Okay.
And anyway, he raised cattle, and then he'd winter them down here, and then he'd herd them up to the North Fork. And they get right there, just before you get to Fool Hand Hill on the right, there used to be a logging camp there. And there was a little meadow, and he'd stay overnight with them there the first night. But he'd get a calf, and he'd put the calf in the back of the pickup. And of course, then the cow would follow the pickup. And she went along behind and herded along and get up there. Took him two to three days to get there.
Yeah.
So Ladenburg also ran cows up there, yes or no?
Yeah, he always had cows at different times, you know. But he tried to run too many, you know. That place, if you got 40 head of cattle, that's a lot. Because if you can't grow enough feed for them and you have to buy hay, you're going in a hole. And he'd build a herd up to 100 head and start buying hay, and then he'd have to sell them off if it wasn't paying out.
We'd have cows on the hill behind us in the snow that would starve to death, and cows that would get over in the park, and one would come out in the spring just half starved to death.
Well, he thought he had them all in, and there were still 8 or 10. He didn't keep very good track of them. He didn't even know exactly how many he had.
Well, upcountry, they would range up there, above Pole Bridge by 5-6 miles, or I don't know how far up they would go, but quite a ways up country.
All over. Well, he depended on his neighbors and people that weren't there for their grass, you know. It's just not cattle country.
Did anybody other than those two run any cows up there, you can remember?
Well, old Cooper used to pasture up there in the summertime, but he'd buy in the spring and then he'd sell in the fall. And you know, he didn't try to winter anything.
About how many head, do you remember?
Pardon?
How many head did he run up there?
Oh, see, he had Donaldson's, you know, and Arnett's place in there. He had all of that, he had that leased. And
but how many cows?
I don't know, he'd run about 60 to 80 head.
But he kept track of them too.
Yeah, yeah, he'd, every evening, you know, they want to get on the road, you know, because that pavement was there and it was, that's warmer, and the cows would get out there and lay down and he'd have to herd them off.
So can you tell us about when he died? Well, you were up there at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... Well, we heard a shot, you know, me and my daughter, and we said, we ought to go up there. He was bothered by a bear, but anyway, we got it working and didn't go up there, and it's a good thing we didn't. Because they'd stabbed him, is what they'd done.
You're talking about Roy Cooper now.
Yeah, yes. Roy Cooper. Yeah, that's who he was talking about, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And he got stabbed with a big chef knife, if you know what they are. They're real long and pointed. And he was sitting in the couch, and they stabbed him here in the neck, and it come out his back and into the couch. You could see the spot where the knife went into the couch. And then
Art
Harker went over there. He was supposed to come over for dinner or something, and he went over there, and Art come down, because we had the only phone in the Norfolk at that time, you know, down to the lower end there. And he
police
said,
radio.
He said, I think Cooper commits suicide. He's sitting there with his hat over his head and blood all over. And then, so we called the cops and they come in. And anyway, they could see it was murder. So then they couldn't do nothing. And it took 2 hours to get a deputy up there. Yeah, they had his horses saddled and they were going to go north into Canada, and Cooper told them they couldn't make it, so evidently they took his word for it, and took all his guns and stuff like that. And there was a bartender at Missoula, and he called the cops, and he said, I think I just bought a hot gun. And he told them about it, and it was one of, Cooper's rifle was one of the only ones he recovered.
Well, Beans, we're on a subject of death. Do you remember anybody else that died in the North Park that you knew?
Frank Evans.
Well, there was just where Cedar Lake is, there's two guys buried about there. I don't know, it was in the 1918 when they had that flu. And anyway, they hadn't been in for quite a while, so they went and checked, and they were both dead in their bunks up there, and they buried him out there. And they can't even find where the cabin is anymore.
So how did Frank Evans die?
Committed suicide.
Did you know him very well?
Yeah, I knew him pretty well, yeah. In fact, I'm probably one of the few guys that ever got any of his rose petal wine. He used to pick rose petals and make wine.
I got some.
Did you?
Yep.
Yeah, it was very fragrant.
Yes, it wasn't bad.
Yeah, it wasn't bad.
I forgot about that, Rose Petal Wine.
Yeah.
What was her name?
His wife's name or his girlfriend's name?
His girlfriend.
Ginny.
Yep, she had another name.
I don't
know. Moonbeam, Moonshine, Moon...
Bean Blossom.
Bean Blossom.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I stopped there one time. I was doing some clearing for him, cutting some brush off. And when we got done, he says, I'll make you some sassafras tea. That's the only time I ever had it yet. It's really different. But I guess originally they used the root. And he says, I found out if you get the bark down close to the bottom of the tree and just use the bark, and it was quite tasty.
He made it different. From something up there?
Pardon?
He made it from a plant up in the North Fork?
No, he picked it up back east from where he was from originally.
Oh.
He called it sassafras tea. I remember he used the bark or the root. But the bark has got it too. He said he had chunks of it there and he just kind of grind it up and make tea out of it.
Remember back when they used to make the bare boards for on your windows and stuff with all the nails in them?
Yes.
And Charlie and Dorothy Ritter had been having trouble with a grizzly bear up there. And they had them all around the house. And Frank Evans went there for something, I don't know what. Leah can probably fill you in on all this. But anyway, he stepped on one of those boards. He had to get all those nails in his feet.
No, they were in his boots. He was trying to, they had a storm door and it was closed and he was trying to get their attention. He was pretty excited. Remember his Volkswagen burned up?
Okay.
And I guess it was on fire out there and he was trying to get their attention real quick, trying to get the fire out. And he had a bear board out there with spikes and they went through his boots and he was out there hollering and he finally got their attention, but it was too late to save anything.
He was always doing some different things. I remember one time I spent the weekend or my day off up there with him. And it must have been in the fall because he had baked apples. And I don't know that I'd ever had a baked apple. I mean, I'd had apple pie, but he had this, like a restaurant size pan. Maybe it was bigger than a 9x13. And he had, 12 baked apples in there stuffed with brown sugar. And they were pretty good.
And raisins.
But the first one was good. But the second one was okay. And then I think we had one for breakfast the next day. Because without proper storage and just him living there, you had to eat all the baked apples right from the beginning to the end. But that was the one thing that was out of place or different that I remembered from him.
You see, that house he had, that was Chance Beebe's homestead. He was there in the early days.
So I always thought it was the Adair homestead, but they must have bought it.
No, that was Chance Beebe's homestead.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And it went up just about to the store and then back on the hill there somewhat. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it does. It goes up on the ridge there, and then right where the T is in front of the store, that's where that fence line that's part of Holbridge subdivision now was their property line, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, he was quite a guy, old Chance was. But he married DeFord. I think that's where Rachel Sweet was. And that was part of that was their DeFord homestead. And he married the DeFord girl and then they moved to town here. Raised her family down here in town. They was in Bad Rock first, and then they moved into Columbia Falls. He was a government trapper, damage control guy. He went out and got grizzly bears and mountain lions and stuff like that. In fact, I don't know where it would be, where a guy'd get it, but they made a movie of him capturing lions alive. They wanted them for the zoo or something, and he ran them up a tree. I remember I seen the movie and he had a tube with ice screwed into it with a little cable and a noose on the end and then he'd put it around her head and lock it and pull them out of the tree and send them to the zoo.
Well, what do you say we call it off for today?
They didn't have tranquilizer guns them days.
Is this, over your knowledge of the North Fork, is that pretty fair assessment of how people came and went up there?
They'd have a family. They'd have to get the kids to school.
School.
Things like that. Like Dewey Parrish, I remember him. They homesteaded up there. He was back in the community hall there, back in there. And just, he was a great guy for finding bees. You know, bee trees and honey trees. But the lower North Fork down here, you know, from here to Columbia Falls to Canyon Creek there was a lot of cedar.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were hollow and that was just a perfect home for bees and he'd go along and he'd find them. He'd put out a bait station, you know, with sugar water and get the bees coming to that. And then he'd follow a bee for as far as he could see him and then pretty soon another bee'd come by and pretty soon he'd find the nest.
So he was tracking bees.
Yeah.
I would have never thought to do that. Shows how little I know about the outside world.
Yeah.
That would have been. Did you guys ever find any honey and have an abundance of it?
Well, my dad, my granddad did, I remember. I remember they had a big cedar tree. I remember a little kid and they fell it down and broke open and there was two hives in the same tree. You couldn't believe how much. We had wash tubs full of honey. And boy, was that good honey. Of course, with the kids around, ours didn't last as long as Grandpa's did. I can remember going to Grandma's and she'd have fresh bread and the honey. Yeah, that was. Well, in the early days, I can remember Lower North Fork here, you know, when there were the shooting ranges there, but my granddad had a homestead, my mother had a homestead there. The hills after the fire were just pink. Were just pink with fireweed.
Boy, that makes good honey.
And then, oh, I don't know, probably about the 1st of June, they'd bring in several carloads of sheep, and they'd unload them here, and they'd start up the North Fork. And they'd wind up, you know, before fall, you know, as the summer progressed and as the feed opened up on the high ridges, they'd be up there on the high ridges on the Whitefish Divide and pasture sheep in there. So that in Werner Basin, I can remember it was in 53, I think it was, I was in there, and there was a little camp area there, and they had a big rock, had SD Small Sheep Camp, 1935. And I think that was about the last year, 36, probably was about the last time they brought them into the Whitefish Divide.
Hmm. So sheep have never been really big in the valley, have they?
Pardon?
Sheep have never really been a big crop or herd in the Flathead Valley.
No. No, I can't remember anybody having any sheep down here.
Yeah, I can't either.
Yeah, Fuzzy Barton was. There was one guy who had four or five bands, but they hired Fuzzy to pack groceries to the different camps and stuff. They had some on Striker, and he had a couple of horses, and he'd take groceries to the guys all summer long. He said they brought him a rifle and all the ammunition, and he was supposed to shoot every bear he saw. He claimed he killed several hundred bears. I don't know if he did or not. That's what he claimed. And the CC's had a road that went up Big Creek and followed it up and went up to Larson's homestead. He had a couple of homesteads up there. And then Hollowat, there was no road in. There was a road on the state land. But then when you got up there on North Coal and South Coal, there was no roads in that area when I first went in. And there was a lot of game them days.
Lots of bears too.
And you know, and most of the people didn't want mule deer, they wanted whitetails. Uh-huh. You know, and they didn't really hunt them.
Is there a difference in your book between whitetail and mule deer?
Oh, if you get them when they're out in a rut, I think I prefer mule deer to whitetail. They're I like them. If you get them in a rut, you know, and they ain't very good.
Haven't got enough garlic to cover it up.
Good point. Yeah, bull trout were really big back in your early days. I remember my uncles talking about fishing at Big Creek and catching, man, pictures of really big bull Dolly Varden. Mm-hmm. Did you fish for those at all, or?
Well. Yeah, let's see, Big Creek, Cold Creek, Trail Creek, and Whale Creek have been closed to fishing for as long as I can remember.
Oh.
They were spawning streams and right. They always had them closed. In fact, one year they did open it up for 2 weeks in a year, but it was right when the fish were spawning and they didn't know where they were spawning and they let fishermen go in and they had a check station at Big Creek and you had to tell them where you got the fish and things like that. But it was only for a 2 week period. It was a very short period of time.
So did you ever fish for it? Were you a big fisherman?
Oh yeah, I did a lot of fishing.
Did you can bull trout?
I canned them before we were married.
Yeah.
But
my mother used to count them all the time. Because after I got to going to school, you know, we had a place, we stayed at Grandpa's place or something down here, and that was, I just loved to go. You allowed two a day, and that, you know, 4, 5, 6 pounders, you could catch them, nothing to it. Now, my dad was a fisherman, and we'd go fishing. And in fact, my grandmother out on the Corn Spur, there was a cedar camp out there, and my grandpa and grandma cooked there.
Cedar,
where Henry Raby was.
So you say cedar camp, was that for cedar lumber or shakes or?
No, they took out poles and posts. They'd get an order for poles and then they'd go through there. And of course the poles are pretty, it's gotta be really good timber for poles. Can't be no rot in them or no rot on the outside and things like that. And then the hollow ones, you know, if they had a shell on them, they'd make posts out of them. In fact, before the fire, right where the Blankenship Bridge is, there was a patch of cedar there, great big stuff, 4, 5, 6 foot on the stump. Wow. My granddad logged that out before there was any roads in there at all.
So was that?
That was about, 1915, I think it was, somewhere there.
Yeah, early fires.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad wasn't big enough to be in the woods yet then. Right. He was just a little kid, but granddad used to go in there, and him and Corbett, that was his nephew, and they got that stuff out.